Sid Barrett wrapping up that short set of music as we are approaching the top of the hour with Octopus. Before the Sid Barrett, the Toadies went back to an album they put out called Heretics, where they re-envisioned a lot of their songs. So I played their big hit from the 90s, Possum Dixon. Possum Dixon. That's another band. Possum Kingdom, the name of the song I played for you. Hey, you know what? I do need to remind you of one thing and one thing only. That's each and every Thursday, you can join your rockin' attorney, Eric Jackson Lurie, for Quartz in Session. It's 2.5 hours of rock and roll, country, and soul with a focus on new music by your favorite classic artist. Again, it's Thursdays at 8, and it re-airs on Monday afternoon. Monday afternoon. You are listening to the Viva La Mock radio program, and my name is Paul, and I appreciate you listening. As always, you're thinking, hey, there's a song I want to hear on a future show. Well, you know what you have to do. There's only one thing you have to do. You have to email me. So if you email me, I might play it. Yeah, so the email address is wrctrequest@gmail.com. Indeed, that is the email address.
You are listening to An Experiment with Time on WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM over the airwaves in the city of Pittsburgh. Streaming online to the world up on WRCT.org.
The lessons here is that defeating the kind of fascism we face now requires something deeper than defeating the current administration or winning elections. But it requires a deeper ideological shift. That means thinking beyond nation and pledging allegiance, not to Israel, not to the United States, but to the world and all life, all living things. It means standing up for the oppressed everywhere, right? That's what solidarity means.
That's Robin R.D. Kelly, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Robin D.G. Kelly, Solidarity and Black Resistance to Fascism and Genocide. Langston Hughes, the great African-American poet, said decades ago, "Fascism is a new name for the kind of terror the Negro has always faced in America. Fascism can and has led to genocide." Progressive African-American intellectuals, writers, poets, musicians have had a long tradition and history of solidarity and resisting fascism and genocide. From Frederick Douglass to Gil Scott-Heron, from Sojourner Truth to Angela Davis, from W.E.B. Du Bois to John Lewis, from Paul Robeson to Amiri Baraka, from Ida B. Wells to Malcolm X, from Ella Baker to Dr. King, from Harry Belafonte to Sonny Rollins, from James Baldwin to Cornel West, and up to the present moment where Robin D.G. Kelly warns we're witnessing the consolidation of a fascist police state. Our guest today is Robin D.G. Kelly. He's professor of history at UCLA, a distinguished scholar, public intellectual, and award-winning author. Among his many books are Race Rebels, Thelonious Monk, and Freedom Dreams. He spoke at UMass Amherst in April 2025. And now, Robin D.G. Kelly.
So I want to begin with where we are now. Let me start with the recent story about someone MAGA leaders call an American hero, a patriot. So on May Day 2023, the ex-Marine Daniel Penny choked to death an unarmed, unhoused black man named Jordan Neely on a Manhattan subway train. Now, Neely was deemed a threat because he shouted, "I want food, I'm not taking no for an answer, I don't mind going to jail and getting life in prison, I'm ready to die." Now, you all know the story, I'm not going to repeat that. Penny was arrested 11 days later, but only after public pressure forced the police to arrest him. Wealthy Republicans gave generously to his defense fund. He raised like $2.8 million in 6 weeks. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, which is like the second most embarrassing graduate of Yale University, you called him a good Samaritan. And you're like, who's first? J.D. Vance, right? So he called Penny a good Samaritan, which, you know, it's a bizarre association when you think about it, given the fact that he's Catholic and clearly hadn't read the Bible, because Jesus' parable of the good Samaritan, he stops and helps a man who had been badly beaten and robbed, bandaging his wounds, housing and caring for him when others pass him by, you know? So Daniel Penny killed the suffering man in need, and for this he was rewarded. He walked out of the courtroom on December 9th, 2024, a free man, richer than he had ever been, and a darling of the MAGA movement. 5 days later, Trump invites Penny to watch the annual Army-Navy football game in his luxury box. And who is he joined by? Elon Musk, Ron DeSantis, and J.D. Vance, who wrote on social media, it was a scandal Penny was ever prosecuted in the first place. Now, of course, this is a repeat of Kyle Rittenhouse, who received, you know, the same kind of treatment for killing two unarmed Black Lives Matter protesters in Wisconsin in 2020. The right poured $2 million into his war chest. Trump praised him and invited him to the White House. And in fact, it came out later, Trump ordered federal law enforcement to say positive things about Rittenhouse to the press. And Bill Ackman, which is the man who's trying to make Harvard white again, called Rittenhouse a patriot. Now, in February of this year, Andreessen Horowitz, a leading Silicon Valley venture capital firm, hired Daniel Penny, having no prior experience in finance. In fact, Mark Andreessen, co-founder of the firm, he had given the Trump campaign like $3 million, both in a super PAC and directly to his campaign. And he also continues to provide vital support for Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency. Now, tall, fit, blonde-haired, chiseled figures, features, he's an Aryan ideal. Daniel Penny was the perfect symbol for America's fascist turn under Trump and Project 2025's plan to dismantle much of the administrative state, curtail civil liberties, concentrate power in the executive branch, and redistribute wealth upwards. Now, Penny embodied the kind of pared-down muscular state, right? Operating alone, above the law, willing to do what it takes to annihilate the threat. And that threat, of course, is an unhoused, disabled, so-called violent Black man. Jordan Neely represented all that was wrong with America. Dependency, entitlements, Black criminality, liberal constraints on law enforcement, DEIA, even the existence of public transportation. Penny represented the will and the vision of the Heritage Foundation and the cabal of unelected billionaires committed to eliminating the social safety net, workers' bargaining rights, affordable health care, public health safeguards, enforcement of civil and disability rights, academic freedom, investment in renewable energy, regulations on pollution and fossil fuel extraction, as well as criminalizing anti-racism, anti-sexism, and trans identity. Rising white nationalism, racist violence, xenophobia, and the economic deterioration of the working class prepared the way for Trump's second term and the imminent reality we're facing right now. Project 2025 and the alt-right, their roots go back to Charles Koch. If you look at, you know, the origins of the Institute for Humane Studies in 1961, for example, or Murray Rothbard, or Charles Murray and Richard Herrnstein, who were the authors of The Bell Curve, that claimed race explained IQ differences. Now, these cats believe in eugenics. Okay, this is very important. They believed in human diversity, right? But human diversity as fixed, immutable, and hierarchical. They insisted that some groups or stocks, right, were not suitable for freedom or self-rule precisely because of their genetic makeup. So consider at least three people who actually contributed to Project 2025. Dr. Jason Richwine, doctor, remember, got a PhD, doesn't make you smart. He argued that Latinx people had lower IQs than white people and proposed using IQ tests to determine immigrant entry into the United States. And he was just appointed to a very high-ranking position at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Corey Stewart, a failed GOP Senate candidate from Virginia, defender of the Confederacy and the Confederate flag, he had direct ties to Jason Kessler, who organized the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in 2017. Now, Richard I don't know why I can't say this, because he disturbs me so much. Hanania, who promoted eugenics and forced sterilization of low IQ people, which he suggested were mostly black people. Actually, I know why I can't say his name, and I'll say it in a second. He wrote for alt-right white nationalist publications under pseudonym, and he published this terrible book called The Origins of Woke. He also earned a PhD from UCLA in 2018, and I used to see him, you know, in political science. No disrespect for the discipline, but, you know, in 2010, he wrote, "If the races are equal, why do whites always end up near the top and blacks at the bottom, everywhere and always?" He wrote, "For the white gene pool to be created, millions had to die. Race mixing is like destroying a unique species of or piece of art. It's shameful." Hanania also wrote a recent statement on social media. He said, "Daniel Penny getting charged, these people are animals, whether they're harassing people in subways or walking around in suits." It's ironic because Hanania would not be considered white by MAGA standards because he's Palestinian Christian of Jordanian descent. Okay, so one of the points I want to make here is that when Trump issues an executive order ending illegal discrimination and restoring merit-based opportunity and accuses DEIA of violating federal civil rights laws and undermining American values of hard work, excellence, and individual achievement in favor of unlawful, corrosive, these are his words, or actually the statement's words, corrosive and pernicious identity-based spoiled systems. We know it is a lie because they don't believe it. And if you need proof that they believe in a merit-based opportunity system, all you have to do is look at Trump's cabinet picks, right? They don't believe in merit-based. Think about that. Or look at Daniel Penny's job offer. You know, no skills, and yet he's got this gig. Besides, if the Trump Project 2025 people really believed that white men are real victims of racism, then they would not dismantle the laws, institutions, and agencies designed to address discrimination. In fact, what they would do is they repurpose those institutions that are designed to address discrimination for the purposes of protecting white people. But what they're doing instead is claiming the right to be racist and to use the levers of the state to reinstitute a form of apartheid or Jim Crow. And instead, they turn to fiction. And, you know, the amount of fiction that comes out of these executive orders and comes out of the mouths of all these people, it's astounding to me, you know. But Trump's most recent executive order claims the Smithsonian Institution is, quote, "under the influence of a divisive, race-centered ideology that promotes, quote, narratives that portray American and Western values as inherently harmful and oppressive." Of course, no one teaches that. Restoring truth and sanity, according to the order, means accepting race as a biological reality. Now, I want you to follow me here. He's arguing, or I shouldn't say he, the people behind Trump, the whole Project 2025 people, the people who go back to the bell curve, are actually arguing that race is a biological reality and not a social construct. The very idea that race is a human invention, according to Trump, is a dangerous lie. And of course, that makes perfect sense given the logic, because if you believe that diversity or difference is immutable, and that there's a kind of a hierarchy, then you have to believe that race is biological. You can't believe it's socially constructed. Now, promoting ableism is a central part of their plans. And as we know, it's foundational to fascism. It's as important as race, right? Ableism. The able body is a metaphor for the nation. They're obsessed with masculine energy, with trad wives. They continue to defund medical research, dismantling the EPA, shielding corporations from liability, from anything, for pollution, manufacturing chemicals like herbicides, like Roundup, workplace injury, firearms manufacturing, and just deregulating all that. And all of these assaults are on people with disabilities. And of course, don't be surprised when they start proposing, you know, forced sterilization, which is a universal fascist policy. Now, Trump's anti-trans orders harken back to the Lavender Scare of the 1940s and 50s, which intertwine homophobia and anti-communism and resulted in a kind of, in the purging of at least some 5,000 queer people from federal government jobs. And in fact, if you count the numbers, way more people were fired as a result of being gay or lesbian or being accused of being gay or lesbian, whatever, than communists. You know, the Lavender Scare was way more devastating in terms of people's lives. Nevertheless, you know, and this is in some ways the Trump era is a combination of those things. Trump issued at least 6 anti-trans executive orders, banning what it calls harmful gender ideology, declaring there are only 2 sexes, collapsing gender identity under the category of sex, requiring that all official documents, such as visas and passports, use only the sex assigned at birth, barring trans people from sports and the military, punishing schools for supporting trans students, prohibiting federal funding for gender-affirming care for anyone under 19, or any medical schools, for that matter, or hospitals that research transgender health. So if you take all this stuff together, these bans essentially facilitate the destruction of trans people as an identity group, stripping them of any federal recognition or any legal protections. And you know what that's called? It's called genocide. That is the definition. The Lemkin Institute for Genocide Prevention and Human Security has already warned that Trump's executive orders and the policies that follow, quote, are in line with a genocidal process against the transgender community. And the last one I want to talk about is this police state we're living under. One of the functions of the state that DOGE has not slashed is the coercive arm. Law enforcement, you know, with the exception of the FBI, and that's a very specific thing. And military continue to enjoy strong financial support, but the administration has practically eliminated any sort of accountability or police misconduct. So on his first day in office, the same Trump granted clemency, the same day that he granted clemency to nearly 1,600 felons convicted of crimes associated with the January 6th insurrection, he rescinded Biden-era police and criminal justice reforms. He restored the federal death penalty, made the killing of a police officer a federal capital crime, and directed the Attorney General and the Secretary of Homeland Security to establish Homeland Security task forces to be made up of federal, state, and local police officers. Under the guise of fighting violent crimes, it serves as a deportation force. It raids workplaces, apartment complexes, neighborhoods, and universities where it has abducted and jailed 4 national students just for protesting the genocide in Gaza. So by executive order, Trump also created the DC Safe and Beautiful Task Force. Think about that. DC for District of Columbia. Headed by who? The racist Stephen Miller. And the task force will coordinate local officials to deport so-called illegals, increase the overall police presence, and speed up the processing of applications to carry concealed weapons. You think about what that means, right? So we're witnessing the consolidation of a fascist police state, although, and then this is one of the points I want to make right now, is that for some of us, this has been a permanent feature of life. So Langston Hughes, who in a speech in 1936 said, fascism is a new name for that kind of terror the Negro has always faced in America. You know, this kind of terrorism is extending more and more to groups of peoples whose skins are not black. Now, Hughes, of course, was not alone in understanding fascism in this way. Black radical intellectuals, you know, had located the roots of European fascism in the colonial order long before Hannah Arendt or Jean-Paul Sartre, and others had made the same argument. And, you know, after World War II, the publication of Aimé Césaire's Discourse on Colonialism, where he argued that the real crime of fascism was the application of colonial procedures to Europeans, which, quote, until then had been reserved for the Arabs of Algeria, the Coolies of India, and the blacks of Africa. And he observes that Europeans tolerated Nazism, this is a quote, before it was inflicted on them, that they absolved it, shut their eyes to it, legitimized it, because until then, it had been applied only to non-European peoples. Think of it, he continues. 90,000 dead in Madagascar, Indochina trampled underfoot, crushed to bits, assassinated, tortures brought back from the depth of the Middle Ages. And my favorite quote from Du Bois from The World in Africa, where he writes, there was no Nazi atrocity which Christian civilization or Europe had not long been practicing against colored folk in all parts of the world in the name of and for the defense of a superior race born to rule the world. In other words, fascism was not some aberration from the march of progress. It was the logical development of Western civilization itself, a civilization based on racial classification and hierarchy, on colonial domination, capitalist exploitation, and violence, the violence that comes with it, dispossession, enclosure, slavery, state regulation, and state regulation and reproduction. So settler colonialism is an expression of this incipient fascism. That's when we talk about the long durée. The fascist state never portrayed itself as against the people. It claims to be an expression of the people partly to protect us from those who are not the people. You know, so in other words, the people are those who are outside the people. Those are the others, black people, immigrants, Jews, Roma. And we can call this anti-democratic democracy. It's always grounded in the production of racial difference and is foundational to settler colonialism. Therefore, from this perspective, fascism is not at odds with liberal democracy. In fact, Michael Hanchard shows in his book, The Spectre of Race, every modern democracy was founded as an ethno-national racial state. Every single one. Think about it. Every modern democracy was founded as an ethno-national racial state. That means the exclusion, subjugation, and persecution of some other are not the people, right? So we're talking about democracy for the people. It's not always for all the people. The rise of fascism and the global economic crisis was the context for the radical turn in black scholarship. And, you know, you've got W. Du Bois writes the Black Reconstruction in 1935. C.L.R. James writes History of Negro Revolt, the Black Jacobins in 1938. You have the writings of Louise Thompson Patterson, George Padmore, Claudia Jones, Marvell Cook, Ella Baker, Richard Wright, and so forth. They were all produced in response to fascism and the growing anti-colonial movement. And as Cedric Robinson argued decades ago, the confrontation with fascism led these same intellectuals to study and examine black revolt through a kind of limited Marxist lens, forcing the best of those to adjust that lens, right, and therefore contribute to a new understanding of expressions of black resistance. The black left saw fascism on the horizon because it was familiar to them. They knew it. They recognized it. They were what they used to call premature anti-fascists. So when the American ruling class was celebrating Mussolini, for crushing communists and labor and bringing about stability in Italy, right? African Americans and the black, the diaspora as a whole, was resisting that. If I can go to the next slide, I think. The mainstream press, right? This is the U.S. press and the Western press generally. They loved Mussolini. They loved him. They ran admiring and fawning articles on Mussolini and the success of Italian fascism throughout the decade, even into the mid-1930s. So we're talking about Fortune magazine, Time magazine, owned by Henry Luce, Business Weekly, Survey Graphic, Barron's, The New Republic, and the Saturday Evening Post ran a bunch of articles. In December 1927, issue of Nation's Business, which was the official organ of the Chamber of Commerce, its editor, Merle Thorpe, published an editorial titled "That Man Mussolini." And he wrote, and you know, he's in love with Mussolini. He says, "I can understand why a businessman would admire Mussolini and his methods. They are essentially those of successful business, executive action, deeds, not words. The impression you get of Mussolini is that he is a fine type of business executive. He cuts through, not fine-spoken theories, not plans, not speeches he's going to make, none of these. Things done, and that is your successful American executive." The president of the New York Stock Exchange, E.H.H. Simmons, praised Mussolini for defeating communism, which he called, quote, that evil disease from the Orient. And that's something to remember. J.P. Morgan loaned Italy like $100 million in 1926. So fascism, to sum up this part, or what Mussolini called corporatism, proved to a certain extent to be capitalism's savior. So what are the characteristics of fascism? Abandoning democracy and civil liberties under the guise of a state of emergency, an authoritarian state built on an ideology of racial destiny, which justifies internal violence, that is, ethnic cleansing, racial cleansing, and external expansion. And note that all fascist and authoritarian states pursued some level of imperialist ventures, every single one. Brutally suppressing strikes and outlawing labor unions is another kind of element or component of fascism. In other words, making workers dependent on a coercive state. But let me just say a couple words about Italy to illustrate my point about the colonial roots of fascism. So bear with me. So like a lot of Europe, basically almost all of Europe after World War I, Italy, you know, ended the war in debt, high unemployment. You have strike waves everywhere, especially in Turin, working class insurrections, often led by socialists, communists, and anarchists. The Liberal Party was in power in Italy, but lost control of the economy and the country. Mussolini, who was a former socialist, got to remember that, who left his party because of his opposition to nationalism. And just a side note, the most amazing thing about the Italian Communist Party and Italian socialists is that they held on to internationalism. They resisted the war, whereas a lot of the other socialists in the Second International, they became nationalists right away. So Mussolini's pissed off about that, so he formed the Black Shirts, these paramilitary squads made up of disgruntled veterans. They attacked socialists and communists. The Liberal Party had a choice. Now, they could have collaborated with the Communist Party or the fascists, and they chose the fascists. Liberals make bad choices. I'm just saying. So trade unions called a general strike in 1922. The fascists crushed the strike, marched on Rome, and basically seized power because they were not interested in collaboration with the Liberal Party. The Liberal Party just capitulated, saying, well, here, you got power. So Mussolini's now in power. He's set to rebuild the Roman Empire to restore national pride. So what does he do? Well, he already has Libya, so he invades Ethiopia. Now, we have to pay attention to the brutality of Italian colonialism because one of the big myths about Italian fascism is that it was more benign and not as racist as, say, the Nazis. The fascists did come to see themselves as a race, right? A Mediterranean version of Aryans. And while they did not organize Jewish death camps to that degree, they practiced fascist violence in the colonies. But even before the fascists, and this is the most important thing I really want you to take away with this, before the fascists came to power, right, Italy, like all imperial countries, waged a brutal genocidal war in the colonies. So during the Italo-Turkish War in 1911, Italy colonized Libya, which had been a part of the Ottoman Empire. Under the Liberal Party, so it's under the Liberal Party that Italy's occupying forces gassed and starved Libyans, created concentration camps, ultimately killed one-tenth of the population. In 1935, jump forward, the Italian military used mustard gas on Ethiopians in violation of Geneva protocols of 1925, which banned its use, killed 250,000 Ethiopians within 3 years of the war, and by some estimates, one-third died from chemical weapons. And this may sound familiar, they bombed Red Cross hospitals and ambulances. They massacred prisoners. Italy's occupation of Ethiopia lasted until 1943, and Italy did not formally recognize Ethiopia's sovereignty until 1947. But the biggest issue to me is that the Western countries were very quick to recognize Italy's occupation of Ethiopia as legitimate, and war crimes were ignored until 1940, when other Western powers entered, the war against Italy. They still didn't really address war crimes. Soviets initially said nothing before the League of Nations, in part because they were selling coal and oil to Italy. So technically, and this is an argument that I make all the time and been making it for 30 years, World War II begins on African soil.
You're listening to Robin D.G. Kelly, Solidarity and Black Resistance to Fascism and Genocide. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
World War II begins on African soil. It begins in Ethiopia. That is the beginning. That is the front. From there, Italian troops attacked British colonies in Somalia, in Egypt, Sudan, Kenya, like around 1940. Okay, so African Americans immediately mobilized in defense of Ethiopia, raising money for relief and medical aid. Black communists in Harlem, especially with the help of some Garveyites, created the Provisional Committee for the Defense of Ethiopia. Black men from across the nation volunteered to fight. The Pan-African Reconstruction Association recruited 1,000 volunteers in New York, 1,500 in Philadelphia, 8,000 in Chicago, 5,000 in Detroit, 2,000 in Kansas City. The Garveyite Black Legion established a training camp in upstate New York for some 3,000 volunteers, and they were ready to fight. They were ready to go to Ethiopia to fight, right, to defend Haile Selassie. And that's another complicated thing. But Selassie was pressured by the U.S. to refuse these volunteers, and only two African-American combatants ever reached Ethiopia, and both were pilots. So the first location in Europe, though, where the war began was Spain. So in 1936, when Franco led a military campaign to overthrow the Republican government of Spain, the Loyalists, right, consisting of a popular front government of socialists, communists, anarchists, and liberals, they were attacked by Franco, and Franco's armies were supported by what? German planes and Italian planes. Germany and Italy provided arms, supplies, and aerial attack squads. The so-called Western democracies claimed neutrality, even as American corporations like Texaco, Texas Oil Company, extended credit to Franco's forces. Only the Soviet Union and Mexico came to the aid of the Loyalists. And this is interesting when you think about it because, I'm trying to think about where we are now and what does it mean to back a violent genocidal war, right, with resources, and no one comes to the aid of those who are being killed except for those who volunteer. So the Loyalists appeal to volunteers. who came from all over the world, and you may know the story, 3,000 people from the United States came to fight or participate in the war in Spain. 90 were African-American, and one black woman, Celera Key, served as a nurse. Crawford Morgan, originally from North Carolina, spoke for nearly all black volunteers when he linked the events in Ethiopia with fascist tendencies. In the U.S., mainly, he argued, Negroes have been getting lynched in this country by mobs. So he says, this is what fascist tendencies look like. Vaughn Love, another volunteer, had collected medical supplies for Hands Off Ethiopia, and then he fought in Spain, defined fascism as, quote, the enemy of all black aspirations. So what I'm saying here is that we date the beginning of World War II in Europe to 1939, when it really begins in 1935 in Africa. When fascists invade Ethiopia, Western capitalist nations didn't care because it was Africa. When fascists backed the civil war in Spain to overthrow an elected government, the Western capitalist nations didn't care because they're communists and socialists. All the while, fascists are doing business with U.S. companies, and their forces are getting stronger. In other words, they're strengthening, U.S. capital strengthening fascism in Germany and Italy this whole period. And then they're going to turn around and fight them. Now, if we turn to like Crawford Morgan and Vaughn Love and Langston Hughes about fascism in the South, it's an interesting kind of story. Now, a lot of people are familiar with the fact that Nazis drew directly on American eugenicist ideas about the purity of blood and Aryan superiority. They know that the Nuremberg laws, for example, were modeled after U.S. Jim Crow laws. And we know that, and that's interesting. But see, to me, that part's not surprising. Of course, the U.S. is the basis, the roots of so much racism. I know, I live here, you know. But to me, the main story is something else. First, that these models were not just building blocks for German fascism, but they were evidence of existing fascism in the U.S. South. Violence was the primary mode of governance, and much of the violence was outsourced, which is the roots of slave patrols, you know? And before that, I just learned. The system of law enforcement, and when I say law enforcement, let's read it as property protection, depended on deputizing every white man. The state didn't have to take responsibility for the violent subjugation of its black population when you have a few million Daniel Pennies and Kyle Rittenhouses ready to do it. The South was a one-party dictatorship under which white property ruled. And that white property rule in the South extended to the nation. Let me explain. So by denying black people the vote, Southern congressmen enjoyed a concentration of power. They chaired 29 of the 47 committees in the House, 13 of 33 committees in the Senate, and these were all the most powerful committees: judiciary, agriculture, appropriations, banking and currency, commerce, finance, military affairs, ways and means. And besides counting black people who could not vote for congressional representation, poll taxes made it impossible for even some poor whites to vote. So voter turnout in southern states was like 20% or lower, right, of eligible voters. And not because people didn't want to go vote, right? And so they end up getting the most powerful legislators in Congress and Senate, who then have seniority because they keep being voted in. A white property dictatorship in the South explains why there was no federal anti-lynching bill passed under Roosevelt. In fact, do you know when the federal anti-lynching bill was passed? Thank you, 2022. They also insisted on local control of all New Deal agencies to ensure unequal wages, payments, and maintain segregation. So this is a Faustian bargain that Roosevelt made. Complete suppression of democracy in the South in exchange for support for the New Deal. So don't keep saying that the New Deal is the greatest thing that's ever happened and we need to go back to that. You know, I understand the loss of the welfare state, but we have to be serious about the history. and how that happened and who lost. But the key point here is that fascism persisted in the U.S., it persisted in South Africa, it persisted in many colonies after Second World War. The Second World War did not end fascism. In fact, it expanded. Claudia Jones, in a brilliant essay published in 1946, suggests that the danger of fascism is not over in 1946, but alive and well in the South. And she writes, "Today the main danger of fascism to the world comes from the most colossal imperialist forces which are concentrated within the United States. The perpetrators of these attacks are the representatives of the most reactionary section of monopoly capital and of the semi-feudal economy of the Black Belt." And she goes on to talk about what I don't have time to talk about, is there's a wave of lynchings and killings of Black veterans in particular, right up from 1945, 46, 47, throughout. And we know what happens after that in terms of Black people trying to get the right to vote. It's just nothing but chaos and violence. So that's why in 1951, Paul Robeson and William L. Patterson, who's the executive of the Civil Rights Congress, submitted a 225-page petition to the United Nations Assembly, General Assembly, titled "We Charge Genocide: The Crime of Government Against the Negro." And Patterson and his team use what was then new, the UN Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, which was adopted by the UN General Assembly December 19, 1948. And they used that, the Convention on Genocide, to make the case that Black people were victims of genocide. Now, in documented racial violence after the war, at least 153 killings of Black people, and presented a legal argument that identified systematic violence and terrorism as part of state policy to crush movements of opposition and maintain the racial and class status quo. Now, Raphael Lemkin, who coined the term genocide, he had a fit. He insisted, first, it didn't apply to Negroes. He accused the authors of sabotaging the U.S. Senate's ratification of the convention and, quote, diverting attention away from the crimes of genocide perpetrated in the Soviet Union. Now, in fairness to Lemkin, he changes his mind, by the way. And most people don't like that. They like to attack him. But he actually thought about it, and he said, you know what? Black people do fall under the category of genocide. And then he actually worked on Algeria as well. So in fairness to Lemkin, he actually came around. But my point is, anti-communism, his own anti-communism, made it hard for him to actually see the argument that they're making. But it's not as if Black people didn't know this. That is to say, this is an article, October 21st, 1950, from the Amsterdam News, headline, UN Law May Be Hard on Dixie, which argued that, quote, "the lynching of Negroes in the United States and race destruction in the Union of South Africa would be considered crimes of genocide." So they didn't need Recharge Genocide to know that. All the Black people understood that, certainly the journalists. U.S. senators understood this as well. They understood it all too well, which explains why the U.S. did not ratify the Genocide Convention until 1988. So like previous petitions, Patterson draws a direct line between domestic genocide and colonial war. Of course, the story of Black anti-fascism and resistance to genocide doesn't end here. From 64 to 72, the U.S. had more urban insurrections than any other Western country in the world. In other words, war was taking place. It's not a stretch to say the United States was the epicenter of urban warfare in the Western Hemisphere. And it was also the epicenter of counterinsurgency tactics in the hemisphere. Police and the National Guard turned Black neighborhoods into war zones, arresting tens of thousands of people, employing tanks, machine guns, and tear gas to pacify the community. I don't know why anyone doesn't realize that war was taking place in the United States on U.S. soil. But it just was in the ghettos. Like, that's war. So, therefore, some of these people involved in rebellions sparked by these incidents of state violence named the repression fascist. And they saw themselves as anti-fascist, and hence some of the use of fascism here. So consider Revolutionary Action Movement, the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, the Community Alert Patrol, Black Liberation Army, the Brown Berets, the National Committee to Combat Fascism, the Black Liberation Front. All of them use the term fascism to refer to state violence and to the way the state treated Black people. State and vigilante violence, of course, actually escalates in the 70s and 80s with the defeat of the insurgency in 1968. I just want to say the Black radical tradition against fascism and genocide continues to this day, and so does the deep commitment to internationalism, be it Haiti, Congo, Sudan, and of course Palestine. I want to end by returning to the present and to say a few words about the weaponization of anti-Semitism, something that our university administrators all over the country has chosen to endorse. In spite of the fact that the current administration in the White House attacks any criticism of Israel as cover to shield its own anti-Semitism. That's what they do. So we witness a dress rehearsal of Trump's policies when the House Committee on Education and Workforce, led by Virginia Fox and Elise Stefanik, held McCarthy-like hearings charging, quote-unquote, liberal university presidents with allowing their institutions to become hotbeds of anti-Semitism. Now, if anti-Semitism was the primary concern, they would have investigated the white nationalists and Nazis who attacked our students on my campus at UCLA for their Palestine Solidarity encampment, right? But none of them were investigated. If anti-Semitism was a concern, the January 6th insurrectionists, right, would be investigated. I mean, you had people wearing sweatshirts that said Camp Auschwitz. You had people wearing T-shirts that said 6MWE, 6 million weren't enough. And they all got exonerated, right? Christian Zionists and white Christian nationalists make up a significant part of the MAGA base. They claim to be defenders of Israel, and the Israeli right embraces figures like Reverend John Hagee, head of Christians United for Israel. And this is the same minister who once preached that God sent Hitler to hunt the Jews, and the Jews will suffer for eternity in hell. I'm so stupid. I think that's anti-Semitic, but what the hell? Now, these are the folks who preach the new dispensation that Jesus will rise from the dead, return the Holy Land to the Christians. So whereas Israeli leadership is chomping at the bit to take all of Palestine, you know, Eretz Israel, Christian Zionists are waiting for Judgment Day so that they could take all of Israel from the Jews. In this scenario, financing Israeli aggression and shielding it from international law does not make Jews safer, especially those Jews who are anti-Zionist or just critical of Israeli policies. And the Trump administration will continue to stay silent on right-wing anti-Semitism while punishing all supporters of Palestinian liberation. In other words, and follow me here, the current regime demands fealty to Israel, but not to the Jewish community. Jews are still suspect, and Christianity is perceived to be under threat. And if you don't believe me, read Executive Order 14202, Eradicating Anti-Christian Bias. Just read it. Think about what it means, right, for Zionist organizations like B'Tahr to turn in foreign national students critical of Israel for deportation. Here, I can't help but think about all those Israeli men who show up at our protests, who heckle and disrupt our protests, and they're wrapped in American flags. Sometimes it's like the flag of Israel and the United States, but mostly American flags. And they're standing there calling for more deportations, when the same government they're working for just pardoned proponents of the Great Replacement Theory. Think about that. They delude themselves into thinking they're safe, right? And of course, none of this is new. And by the way, they're coming for all of us. And I will say publicly right here, I'm being filmed, if they come after anybody, including Zionist Jews, you don't think I'm gonna defend them? Of course I am, because this is about a war against people that's deeply anti-Semitic, and they don't even realize it. It's like they're cutting their own throat. So, of course, none of this is new. Those of us who have been fighting for Palestine's freedom are familiar with Canary Mission. They got a terrible picture of me out there. posting names of people, it falsely accuses of anti-Semitism, or the practice of doxing, which is illegal, or the ADL's long history of spying on progressive organizations or groups such as Israel on Campus Coalition with a $9 million budget to collect information on students and faculty engaged in Palestine justice work and feed that information directly to Israel's Ministry of Strategic Affairs. Now, rather than investigate these organizations for libel or invasion of privacy, or violating the Foreign Agents Registration Act, the state incorporates them into the police apparatus. It's like the deputizing of white men, the deputizing of those Zionist Jews who think somehow that the state that's against them is for them because they do the dirty work of defending a right-wing regime in Israel and defending the occupation, defending war and genocide. So many of us are panicking over Columbia's appeasement. By the way, you know, when UCLA's appeasement appears, it's going to make Columbia look like the resistance. It's just, it's coming. But what they forget, though, is that at least since 2009, American colleges and universities have been relentless in their suppression of Palestine advocacy. They didn't need the Trump administration. Before the encampments, university administrators have been predisposed to arrest student protesters, initiate disciplinary hearings, and rarely have university presidents elected to negotiate seriously in a way that would consider divesting from companies that fuel and finance war and occupation of Palestine. No college or university has suffered financially from divesting from apartheid South Africa, from private prisons, or the fossil fuel companies. Show me one university that went out of business because they divested. Just show me one. You can't, because I'm right. So, you know, histories of anti-apartheid, ironically, right, the anti-apartheid protests on campuses at Yale, Princeton, Cornell, UCLA, are used to advertise their commitment to social justice. I'm sure it happens here, too. The truth is, they are worried about the symbolic costs of bucking the Palestine exception and the real costs in terms of potential loss of donors. That's the thing they're concerned about. Calls for divestment or even a permanent ceasefire elicit absurd charges of being pro-Hamas. Seriously? Anti-Semitic. Proponents of Israel's annihilation. Trustees and donors have gone further, demanding even harsher punishments for student protesters and conspiring with the corporate and legal world to deny them future employment, which is also illegal. And university leaders have chosen to cower before such threats rather than stand up for the rights, well-being, and safety of all their tuition-paying students. And the last point is really crucial because it explains why our universities have become police states. UCLA spent $12 million in spring alone just to suppress protests. The UC system spent on a whole $29 million. My point is that, you know, it's important to name the ongoing attack on critical thought by way of the Palestine exception, waged by our own liberal administrations, because it is so easy to blame the right. The lessons here, for me at least, and this is a kind of broader lesson altogether, is that defeating the kind of fascism we face now requires something deeper than defeating the current administration or winning elections. But it requires a deeper ideological shift. And for me, it means to go to the root, to understand that when we keep repeating Martin Niemöller's words, first they came for the socialists and I did not speak out because I'm not a socialist and so forth and so on, you know, it's kind of disingenuous because we have to find a way to live the implications of the warning, not just repeat them maybe once in a while when things get hard. That is to say, we need to always stand in solidarity and fight for others as if our lives depended on it, right? And that means thinking beyond nation and pledging allegiance not to Israel, not to the United States, but to the world and all life, right? All living things. It means seeing every racist and sexist and homophobic and transphobic act, every brutal act of state violence, every deportation, every denial of health care for the most vulnerable and so forth, as an attack on all of us, as an attack on the class. It means standing up for the oppressed everywhere. And we don't have to ask for something in return, right? That's what solidarity means. And we have to remember, and again, this is the Black radical tradition, that some of the most dynamic movements emerged at the height of racist reaction, economic crisis, war, and militarism. These movements were fueled not by false optimism, but by a deep understanding of the reality that they face. The Black radical tradition understood that the only way to ensure our survival, right, our very survival, was to envision a radically different future for all of us, everyone in it, even the people we don't like, and fight to bring it into existence. Thank you.
You were just listening to Robin D.G. Kelly, Solidarity and Black Resistance to Fascism and Genocide. He spoke in April 2025 at UMass Amherst. Robin D.G. Kelly, a professor of history at UCLA, is a distinguished scholar, public intellectual, and award-winning author. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Heather Cox Richardson, Angela Davis, Gabor Mate, Tariq Ali, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Robin D.G. Kelly on Solidarity and Black Resistance to Fascism and Genocide, and for Howard Zinn's classic book, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Sat Jolly and the Media Education Foundation. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Thelonious Monk, Blue Monk.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hi, I'm Richard Gordon. Welcome to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. Today's episode will be a continuation of the conversation that Riona Duncan and I had with Professors Christopher Mark Jones, an emeritus professor of French and Francophone Studies from Carnegie Mellon University, and Marcy Persine, an assistant professor of classics at the University of Pittsburgh that has been one of Riona's professors. Here comes part two of our discussion of translation and various other language issues.
Isn't there a sense between some different languages, that one language is looked down on by the speakers of the other language?
I think that's historically true. And, of course, it tends to be hemisphere-based, you know, if you look at colonial history and so forth, and even the way colonial history has translated itself into contemporary social realities in Africa, well, or the Americas as well. You don't have to look too far. There you can talk about indigenous languages, for example, which Worf would have said they were equally as rich as any of the Indo-European language tree. So there's a sort of imperialism which reflects itself in language and culture. In other words, when the French went to Africa, what did they bring? They brought the church. So their schools were pretty much missionaries who were teaching French and the culture of la mère patrie, the mother country, France, to people in Mali and Senegal and so forth.
It wasn't just the French. I mean, the Belgian did that too. The Germans did that as well. The English did that as well. The Portuguese, yeah.
Absolutely. And there was no monopoly on this kind of cultural imperialism, but the language went with it. And now, what is the national language of Senegal? Well, it's French, but there are probably dozens of indigenous languages still spoken, and some in a significant way, like Wolof and so forth, so that the uses to which language is put, in other words, there's the language of diplomacy, which used to be French. Now English is pretty much the language